Namaste. Good morning, everyone. It's been a while since the last Zoom session. I'd like to take up a few questions which were received on the email. And thereafter, we can open up the floor for any questions or sharings. For one whose sadhana is self-inquiry and meditation on the self, how to pray for world peace or for healing of someone sick? My wife is asking this. Her sadhana is as above, but she has a strong impulse to pray for certain circumstances that arise. Firstly, our thoughts are with the people who had to flee Ukraine, someone who attends our talks on Zoom, lives in Ukraine, had to flee to Poland. And this disruption in one's life is most unfortunate. Nothing new as far as humanity is concerned. For hundreds of years, there have been wars, displacements, disruption, showing us this aspect of human nature. Now, the question of prayer is an important one in this context, not as in someone who prays generally, but someone pursuing the path of knowledge. Now, if a prayer arises spontaneously, it needs to be allowed to arise because it is natural. There is nothing wrong in a spontaneous prayer arising and pursuing the path of self-inquiry. What distorts this spontaneous prayer, and as Rameshji would say, converts it into a form of begging, is trying to plead and force God for an outcome that one wants, which means there's involvement and a sense of doership. Now, I have mentioned this before, and Rameshji gave a most pragmatic example, being a bank manager. In his days, there was the Kargil War. He was watching the news on TV about the soldiers dying and their bodies being brought back to the airfield. And sadness arose. And a prayer arose for them. Thereafter, he did precisely that which was in his power to do, which was, there was an ad in the newspapers saying, please donate to so-and-so fund for the soldiers. He wrote out a check for the amount which he felt was appropriate, sent it, and as he said, then I left it in God's hands. So it's important to understand that if we are on the path of Jnana Yoga, it doesn't mean we become cold and hardened. It means, in fact, the contrary. We allow nature, which expresses itself in this instance as a form of praying. We allow it to arise. But then we are no longer grasping it, clinging to it. We know that God's will prevails at all times. And so we leave it to God and continue with our sadhana, our self-inquiry, and so on. The problem comes when we start judging the situation, condemning it, getting involved in the, as my friend said, we are all now, from health experts, we become geopolitical experts, opinions about everything. And having an opinion is one aspect, but expressing it with authority, without even knowing the facts of the case, just seeing what we have seen, hearing what we have heard. So it becomes an endless involvement in what has presented itself. That takes away from the sadhana. That is to be watched out for. Am I excessively involved mentally? The thinking mind, hasn't got consumed by the situation at hand? Or do I have objectivity? I certainly have a view. I may certainly express it, but it is done in the moment. I have read your book, The Buddha's Sword, and have not experienced so much of tranquility and peace in my life. My mind has stopped thinking about past events, but I cannot stop thinking about an improvised version of myself all the time. Basically, always thinking about the future. Then I came across your video where you said that engaging your mind in something is an escape because you are afraid the mind will be dead. Please let me know, how can a person be in the present moment without thinking about the future and not engaging your mind in some work? You see, planning for the future is what we all need to do, living in society where we need to earn money. That is an activity of the mind which is classified as the working mind. I take my decisions at work, I see the clients, what they are spending, whatever it may be, my business, and I plan for the future, future outlays. There is absolutely nothing wrong with that. That is in fact normal, to plan for the future. The problem is that when this planning is toxically fear-based, then from the working mind, one shifts to the thinking mind. What will happen if? Again, contingency plans, reserves, for example, are still planning for the future. But if there is this fear, what will happen if this business goes? What will happen if this client goes, this supplier goes, this, that? Anything can happen, as we have all experienced at work. But if the mind is obsessing about that, then one is taken away from what is. Then the mind is no longer in the working mind mode. It is in a compulsive thinking mind mode. And that is the problem, because my peace is now clouded by excessive thinking. Similarly, there is no problem at all in wishing for an improvised version of oneself. Perhaps I feel I have certain flaws and I want to be a better person. All right. But what this teaching brings it down to his first, let's accept we did not create these flaws ourselves. Our circumstances, our conditioning, our nature, and so on and so forth, resulted in these personality traits, which are judged as flaws. Now, I do what I think and feel I should do to improve myself. Absolutely no problem. But the problem once again is when I don't accept myself the way I am first, and thereafter, I get so involved on this mission of self-improvement with so much doership that I am again disconnected from the present moment, because my thinking mind is now sitting in an imaginary future far away. So then I have lost contact. I have lost touch, and I am no longer available to be who I am here and now with what is presented to me by life. But if I accept that as far as my attempts at self-improvement are concerned, all I can do is my best. Thereafter, whether I improve or not is God's will. But what tends to happen is we blame ourselves. Oh, I'm not working hard enough at this. I am not good enough. I am repeating my old patterns over and over again. Why am I continuously doing this? Again, the ego is coming in through the back door, because it feels I can do something to improve myself. Even the thought for self-improvement is God's will. Why doesn't everybody get this thought? Some people get it, others don't. Possibly the ones who don't are better off, because we obsess with it. So you find that with this understanding, with this teaching of Advaita, you are more relaxed, because you realize very little is in my control in any case. Why not I accept this and go with the flow, exactly as I was before, doing what I think and feel I should do in a given situation, but now I know the outcome is not in my hands. The results are not in my control. And I accept sometimes I get what I want, many times I don't. And I walk the middle path. I am walking with the Buddha on the middle path. Now, the joke about this whole self-improvement mission the cosmic joke, if you will, is that the absence of the me with its sense of doership, which leads to peace of mind in daily living, is the highest improvement one could seek. The absence of me with my thinking mind, what a gift that would be. The absence of me without my judgments, without blame, condemnation, hatred, malice, jealousy, envy, pride, shame, and so on and so forth. is the presence of presence. The absence of me and my story is the presence of presence. The absence of the compulsive thinking mind, which is going into the dead past or an imaginary future all the time, is the presence of peace. What other self-improvement is there? When I find I'm operating from this space, where I'm not condemning and judging others, could there be any more improvement than that? When I find I'm driving on the road and a motorbike comes and skims my car, and anger may arise in the moment, but I accept this happened because it was meant to happen. When that acceptance is now operating in my life, what more self-improvement do I need? When I accept that the people I don't like the most are equally entitled to their views and opinions because they are based on their conditioning and God's will, may not coincide with mine, what more improvement do I need? And so I find that this obsession with me, and in this case, improving myself, starts dropping away. This is the dawn of understanding. I mentioned about anger arising on the road as an example, and I am reminded of this example I gave in a talk recently in South India about a client in my advertising days who used to get very angry, to the point that my account executives who were handling his account didn't want to take his calls anymore. And so they would come to my cabin and say, "We are not talking." I said, "You can't do that. He's your client, our client." But this was becoming a problem. Now I knew this client had a short fuse. And I remember at one meeting, he said, "You know, Gautam, I can't help it. But what I do is I call up and apologize." So I tried explaining this to my team that it's okay. He said sorry, he didn't mean to. Now go on with the work. But they were adamant. Anyway, that apart, one day I went to meet him, regular review meeting, and he was looking quite low. And he said that he had an argument with his uncle the evening before. He had an argument with his uncle, he got angry. And of course, he thought in the morning he's going to call and apologize. But this uncle passed away in the early morning hours. He was ailing when he passed away. And he said to me, he said, "I regret getting angry. In spite of my best efforts, I can't control myself. And now I can't apologize." And then he told me, which was so cute, he told me That I'm telling you sorry now only in advance in case I get angry with you. You see, we are all doing our best. What we can do. Now, in his case, whether he goes for therapy, comes across a spiritual teaching, explores his anger, so on and so forth. If he feels he needs to improve himself, he chooses a route based ultimately on his destiny and God's will. This next question is an important one for those who are drawn to this teaching. Recently, I read some writings by you and also the late Ramesh Balsekar. I find the idea that God is the sole doer very liberating, particularly in helping me come to terms with certain things that have happened in my life, thinking of which I used to feel great pain. I am a little confused though, and would be grateful if you could guide me. In your book, The Buddha's Sword, in the chapter Free Will, the Basis of Daily Living, you write, daily living as we know it only happens because the human being has the total free will to do whatever he thinks or feels like doing in any given circumstance. Therefore, it is futile to ask if the human being has free will. If he did not, daily living could not happen. But then, in the next two sections of the book, The Value of Free Will in Practice and The Value of Free Will in Theory, you go on to show that in both practice and theory, free will is worthless. So I am confused here. You seem to be saying that we have free will, and at the same time, we don't actually have it. I can't fully follow this point. Do you feel that instead of saying the human being has the total free will to do whatever he thinks or feels like doing, it might be more appropriate to say the human being is under the illusion that he has the total free will to do whatever he thinks or feels like doing in any given circumstance? And then explain how and why this illusion exists as part of the cosmic drama, or for the drama of daily living where we, under illusion, think that we have free will and are doing things on our own volition. Is it your understanding that while we think we have total free will in daily life to do what we like in any given circumstance, actually, we do not have this free will at all? What we have is the illusion that we have this free will. You see, one could perhaps say it is an illusion. But the problem with this is that if free will is an illusion, even the one wondering whether we have free will or not is equally an illusion. What is an illusion? That which is not real. Capital R. And what is real is that which is always there. Therefore, it is real. Where does free will go in deep sleep? Where does the one asking if we have free will go in deep sleep? So if we are following this thought that free will is an illusion, what isn't? Then what you see, hear, taste, smell, and touch is an illusion. Where does it go in deep sleep? So we understand that free will indeed is the mechanism of functioning in daily living. But it is there in this realm of duality. It is there as the mechanism which makes us live our lives. But previously, I felt my free will was so precious, my free will. Now I understand it is not as precious as I thought it was, because I have seen that it is based on factors not in my control, my conditioning, my genetics, and so on. And I have seen that what happens after I exercise my free will is not in my control. So I act as if I have free will, because I must act in daily living, knowing that this value I assigned to my free will is far more diminished now. Not as important as I thought it was. And it brings a smile to my face, because I know this is the game of life. This is the Leela. I must act as if I have free will, but now the understanding is operating behind me all the time. But hey, look here. Your free will is not so precious. I have shown this to you time and again. And so you find that you flow far more smoothly with what happens in your life than you used to earlier. So it's better to use simpler terms than getting caught up in this illusion part of it, and understand that if we take this approach, then everything is an illusion, which it is, but we have been manifested in this realm of duality, and therefore we must understand that even free will or no free will is just a concept. This whole debate of destiny and free will, these are also the polaric opposites, like rich and poor, front and back, left and right, up and down, pleasure and pain, and so on and so forth. Free will, destiny. But we try the mind, the way it works, it gets hooked onto a concept which it likes, without realizing in doing so it has already created its polaric opposite. Now let's ask ourselves a simple question. When a baby is born, pure being, the question of free will or destiny does not arise. And when the ego forms over time and develops, is there free will? Is everything destined? It is the ego, which is identification with name and form as a separate entity, which is concerned with this issue of free will and destiny. Pure being is not concerned with free will or destiny. Pure being is pure being. But because we see life as a sequence of events in time and action-reaction loops and consequences, we bring in this concept of free will and destiny. The destiny is the destiny of the body and the identification with the body, which is the ego. Being has no free will. Being has no destiny. Being is being. It is the becoming which brings in the free will and the destiny aspects.
Right. If anyone would like to ask something or share anything, they are most welcome to now.
Namaste, Gautam sir.
So, yes, Kumar.
So good to see you again. So the question was, the whole exercise of modern psychology to kind of fix ourselves, do you think that is an exercise in futile? Because like you said, this constant need for self-improvement, and rather using Advaita as disidentifying with those habit patterns, you allow them to play out impersonally, but you are not identified. Like if we read stories of sages, they had some quirky personalities and anger also, but they were never identified. So do you think the modern psychology is a kind of round robin, and the real way out of this is just to disidentify with Advaita, or they can gel at some point?
No, I feel actually it has most certainly has its place in this realm of understanding ourselves better. But what tends to get missed, if one could call it a word, let's say the goal of this, whether it is spirituality, whether it is psychology, whatever it may be, what tends to get missed is what we are seeking is peace of mind. As simple as that. Now, what happens when we know this? Everything we do, whether it is in psychology, in our seeking, and whatever it may be, comes down to, am I more now at peace than I was before? If this does not happen, then we get lost. We get lost in this journey, be it spirituality, be it psychology, in over-analyzing, in trying to, like we were talking about, improve ourselves. We get completely lost, not knowing that, why am I doing this? I'm doing this because I am not at peace. And thereafter, whatever I do, whatever path I follow, I must see whether am I now more at peace than I was, let's say, 6 months earlier. Otherwise, I will be doing it endlessly. For example, now in therapy, there are people who have been doing therapy for 15, 20 years. And I have spoken to therapists about it. Even, I don't think I'm using the right word, but it's similar to what is called a relationship of attachment. Sometimes even codependency happens between the patient and the therapist. But the point you see is missed. Why am I a spiritual seeker, or why am I doing therapy? And whatever else may be a modality I tend to follow is because I am looking for true happiness in daily living, which is peace of mind. So I would not say that, it's a great tool, but even this tool of psychology needs to be understood. Otherwise, it becomes just too much left brain activity. You see, analyzing, over-analyzing, and getting stuck in that whole dimension. So that is my feeling about it.
This is very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. You see, someone mentioned that when we saw you in South India, you were far more taller physically than when you look on Zoom. It just shows, you know, how we form a view of someone based on the screen. That's fascinating. Yes, Chandra.
Namaskar, Gautam.
Namaste.
Gautam, my question is, I'm just getting into Advaita, I will say. I read a couple of books or the question and answer series of Ramana Prabhu. And when I go into self-inquiry, I understand when I read it, I practice it, but it goes away, and then I have to sit back again and then again fetch it. So it's like there's no continuity. I feel shredded. I feel like when the daily life comes, it goes away, and then I'm that ego comes back, that identity comes back, and then I am not the same person who I want to be, or the self is lost, and it's happening again and again. And how to reduce it? I will not say I can, you know, with my workload and social life, but how to reduce this getting lost?
Okay. So, Chandra, you see, we are all living busy daily lives. We are householders, you could say, not sitting in a cave and having adequate time to pursue self-inquiry. So you do the best you can. Frustration is bound to arise because one is dealing with years of hardwired conditioning, patterns, and so on and so forth. So you might find this disconnect between the practice and between daily living. But you see, that is why this teaching is so precious. Because when you start re-looking at your life, the events in your life, the relationships in your life, through the light of understanding, you will find that although this practice of self-inquiry is going on, you will find your dimension, your attitude to life also transforming, your relationship with people transforming. So in that sense, it is not just a practice, but it is permeating your daily living. If you find that is not happening, then there is a disconnect between the practice and what transpires in your day. And that is why I say that this teaching is so beautiful, because you find when, you see, as Ramana Maharshi would say, that there are two approaches. One is practice self-inquiry. The other is surrender everything to God. Now, if one lives this surrendered life, when I accept I have no control what the next moment brings, others I meet speak and say things based on their genetics and conditioning, over which neither did they have any control. Just like myself, I start living a surrendered life. I'm surrendering to a higher force which knows best, because I have my limitations. So once again, Ramana Maharshi's teachings are coming in this way through daily living. And that is why I cannot emphasize enough that just a practice which is isolated as a practice without reviewing your life, your relationships, not only with people, but with the happenings in your life, your relationship with your thoughts, without contemplating on that, reviewing that, seeing it through the prism of Advaita, that is the true practice. And then you find both come together. Because imagine you excel at self-inquiry, but your daily living is a mess. You have no peace at all. Your relationships are as disturbed as they were. Then what is the point? And such practical advice from Ramana Maharshi to do with daily living, keep the self-inquiry practice aside, which I plan to give a talk on soon, where he said, when someone asked him, how does one treat others? And he says, there are no others. What does that mean? If you see that the same consciousness functions through everyone, and we are all instruments of that one source, there are no others, because now your relationship is with God. Not with people whom you have stuck labels on their foreheads. So it must impact daily living. So what I fully understand what you feel when you say that I'm doing the practice, but when it comes to daily life, it's totally disjointed. But this is actually an invitation to look at daily living as the practice.
Because the whole purpose of self-inquiry is to find out who is this me who thinks he or she is the doer of their actions. And the answer is that there's no answer. It is the me that dissolves. Why? Because the understanding comes that all there is the source, consciousness. All right?
Thank you.
Hey, Gautamji.
Yes. Yes, Ram Kumar.
It's been a long time. Many times when I sit in meditation, when there is serenity, you can say the heart, and there is calmness in the mind. Then there's a question arises, what is this life really about?
Can you, sorry, Ram Kumar, can you talk probably into the microphone or instead of looking up, because I'm not able to hear you clearly.
Okay. So, is this voice clear now?
Yeah, better.
Yeah. So, whenever I sit in meditation, when I'm very relaxed from deep inside, I get this question, what is life really about? What is this life really that we are living? We just seem to be undergoing the same experience. Like we're just something which is undergoing experiences. The world keeps happening the same day, night. The body keeps functioning the same always. You see the body activities keep happening. And it's like, it's all just choiceless activities, some appearances and experiences that keep happening. And so, is there any objective really of this life?
So what is the answer you get? You said you keep asking this, so what is the answer you get?
It feels more like and just something that is meant to undergo these experiences.
That is true. That is true. But doesn't it boil down to who am I that is to undergo all these experiences? That is coming back to self-inquiry, or that is coming back to what Rameshji would say, who is this me? You see, because this is the dance of life. This is the dance of Nataraja. You know, everyone's life is a minefield of pleasures and pains, and mostly pains and few pleasures. You know, it's the same story. It's the story of everyone. And this is actually an invitation, just like you are questioning it. We say that anyone who has started asking these kind of questions has found that true happiness does not lie in the flow of life, because it's monotonous, it's the same, there's ups, there's downs. And so the seeking has turned within. No longer externalized, finding happiness depending on pleasures, because pleasures are transient. But now the journey is, I know I can't find it out there, and now I'm going to find it within. So then, what happens is that this being swayed by the experiences of life starts reducing, because that's no longer my focal point. My focal point has turned within, you see. And so that is actually the start of a very beautiful journey, what Nisargadatta Maharaj calls the turning away from the self, which he means the lower self, which was identified with what happened in life. And so, to know at one level the pointlessness of it all is a very big discovery, because it shows that you're not stuck in this anymore. You've seen its futility. It's a very big step. And each one's journey is unique. Because it all boils down to this. It is the ego which is asking this question. What is the point of it all? What is the purpose of life? And the most beautiful answer Rameshji gave is, the purpose of life is the living of it. Because while we are in body, life has to be lived. And that is why Ramana Maharshi said, let come what comes, let go what goes, which is everyone's experience actually. Only we tend to cling to what comes and don't allow it to go and see what remains.
Right, the formless reality has to be like felt from deep inside, the formless.
I wouldn't even use such big words. I would just say that the simplicity and the joy, one could say, of simply being, pure being, without the blemish of doership and all the baggage that comes along with it. Pure being, knowing that everything has its place and time, not obsessing about the future and not living in the dead past. And therefore, as he would say, the purpose of life is to let life flow. As simple as that, nothing bigger than that. All right?
Right.
Okay. Is there anyone else who'd like to ask anything? And if not, we can just sit in silence for a few minutes. All right. I'll just change the view so I can see all of you all. Thank you.